From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Wolves were once the most wide-ranging mammals in North America. They were really everywhere. But after years of human hunting and killing, at one point the continent's dominant wolf, the gray wolf, was nearly extinct in the lower 48 states. In 1995, wolves were reintroduced to Yellowstone National Park. It was a big deal. It still is. My guest today takes us into the story of the wolves' return to Yellowstone, and in particular, of one of those wolves who would become a legend. This hour On Point, the return of the wolves of Yellowstone. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Have you seen the wolves of Yellowstone? And what's your question on their return? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Hear the sound of wolves howling in Lamar Valley, the Lamar Valley of Yellowstone National Park, and lots of wolf watchers in recent years there. Here's a couple reacting when wolves come upon a grizzly bear who is sitting on a bison, a buffalo carcass. The wolf pack chases off another grizzly bear who's just arrived.
The other bear is coming.
Oh, the wolf's kind of gone to it.
Whoa is right, and you hear the cameras clattering there. It's been a big draw in Yellowstone National Park. With me now from Austin, Texas, is Nate Blakeslee, writer-at-large for Texas Monthly, author of the new book, American Wolf, A True Story of Survival and Obsession in the West. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Nate Blakeslee, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being with us.
Tom, thanks so much for having me.
Tell us the story that you tell. People are raving about this story. Give us the outline.
Well, I wanted to tell the story of wolf reintroduction through the story of one particular wolf and one particular pack. I had read a lot of wolf books in preparation for doing this project. Most of them were essays, some were polemics, some were straightforward wildlife biology. I hadn't read one that told a really good story. And my idea was to sort of tell this 20-year battle over the politics of wolf reintroduction and wolf management, but do it through the lens of one particular wolf, one particular pack. I chose the 06 simply because she was, as you mentioned in your intro, probably the most famous wolf ever to live in Yellowstone. The reason I was able to tell her story in such detail is that there are sort of the casual watchers, like the clip we just heard, but there are also these hyper-dedicated watchers who come to the park every day, follow the wolves through their spotting scopes, these telescopes they use every day, and take notes. And one in particular, this retired schoolteacher from San Diego named Lori Lyman, she gave me this treasure trove of notes about 06 and her pack, essentially the diary of a wolf pack. And I read it, and I realized you could use that material to write a nonfiction book that reads like a novel in which the characters are wolves.
Maybe it would be good to set out some basics. I mean, if we go back to 95, 96, they trucked wolves in from Canada, the 31 of them at that point. And now,
yes. Wolves had been gone, as you say, from the park since the 1920s. Been gone from most of the northern Rockies and the lower 48, basically since the end of the 19th century, all trapped out by fur traders and then hunted out by cattle ranchers to protect stock. What you saw in Yellowstone as a result was just this explosion in the elk population, because that was the wolf's main prey. And once they were gone, there was nothing to prey on the elk. The population of elk got so enormous that they began to damage the habitat. They began to damage the prospect for other species. Park rangers knew something had to be done. Essentially, what they did was they replaced the wolves with rifles. They began culling the herds themselves. They would kill thousands in an average year. And then in the 1940s, someone floated the idea, well, maybe the answer is to bring the wolf back. You know, there's plenty of wolves in Canada. We could trap and relocate. Mm-hmm. It was immensely controversial. Those same ranchers that hunted out the wolves, their descendants are still there, still raising stock in the northern Rockies. Elk hunting is big business in the northern Rockies, and wolves eat a lot of elk. So you had hunting guides, you had the motels and restaurants that rely on the hunters coming in every fall. They were all very much opposed. So it wasn't until the mid-90s that the federal government finally managed to get it done, largely over the objections of the local state legislatures there in Montana, Idaho, and Wyoming.
You've got 2.2 million acres in Yellowstone. It is enormous. 31 wolves reintroduced there in 95, 96. Today, I'm reading here something like 100 wolves there, which is just about Yellowstone's carrying capacity. And of all those, you chose one female to focus on. Name? 06. Introduce us to her, where she came from, why she got your attention.
They call her 06. She was named for the year of her birth, 2006. She wasn't the first famous wolf in Yellowstone. After wolves were bought back in the mid-90s, wolf watching wolves from the side of the road through a spotting scope became a very popular pastime. The pack that controlled the Lamar Valley, which is the most popular place to watch wolves because it's open and relatively treeless, that pack, known as the Druids, became quite famous in their alpha pair. Several documentaries were made about them. 06 came along at a time when the Druids' reign was sort of in decline. And in fact, in order to take the valley for herself, she had to outwit and then later actually outfight the alpha female of the Druids. All of this happened at a time when Facebook was really exploding in popularity. She became the first sort of social media star among wolves in the park, and that's partly why she became so famous. But also just the amazing behavior that people were able to witness from the roadside. Her first den happened to be within perfect view of this popular viewing area in the park. So when she brought out her first litter of pups, everybody was able to see them. They were able to see her play with them, raise them. They were able to see her mate and other adult wolves in the pack hunting and providing for the pack. It was like, you know, it was like being able to see a nature documentary, but through your own scope in real time.
Could you describe the range of looks of wolves within Yellowstone and how 06 looks, coloring, size, the way she holds herself or held herself?
Yeah, the wolves are known as gray wolves. That's the common name for the mm-hmm. species. But they can be gray. They can be black. Very occasionally in Yellowstone, they are white. 06 was a gray wolf, an unusually attractive and handsome specimen. She was large for a female, about 105 pounds, an amazingly accomplished hunter. Wolves in Yellowstone hunt elk, which are in the deer family but are very large animals, 4 or 5 times the size of a wolf. The big bulls can get up to 700 pounds. Mm-hmm. Typically, an entire pack is needed to take them down. Part of the reason 06 came to the attention of watchers in the park so early is that she had developed a knack during her time as a lone wolf when she had dispersed from her natal pack of taking down elk by herself, solo, and they saw her do this on many occasions. And that sort of added to her fame. And she's also just a really beautiful wolf. She has a really expressive face. She has kind of an owl-like mask around her eyes. And as I say, they watch these wolves from a safe distance, a mile or two away. Mm-hmm. But these spotting scopes are so powerful. You can see every detail. You can see the expressions on their faces.
People talk about the charisma of this wolf. What do they mean by that? Is it just the size and the sort of beauty of this of 06 or what?
Well, it's funny. You don't want to anthropomorphize, especially if you're a scientist and even as a journalist, you don't want to. But to some degree, you don't have to when it comes to wolves. When you watch them, you realize how amazingly social they are. They routinely show a degree of empathy for one another that is surprising for a wild animal, or was surprising to me and is surprising to a lot of the watchers that come to them. And that is a trait that has been selected for over, you know, the millennia, just like speed or endurance or agility. Wolves hunt in packs. They defend the den collectively. They raise the pups collectively. Being able to understand the emotions of a fellow pack member and respond accordingly is a kind of a survival strategy. And so you can identify individual personalities in wolves just like you can in your dogs. And one of the amazing things about watching them in the park is when you look through the scope, you're seeing this amazingly exotic and wild animal. It's almost like you're looking back into the 19th century, seeing something you were never meant to see. And yet, at the same time, the behavior you're seeing is oddly familiar because you're watching the wolves act like dogs.
One difference, I guess, from the 19th century, certainly in Yellowstone, is that that was the time when wolves were being progressively hunted and trapped to near extinction early in the 20th century. But as I understand, Nate, within Yellowstone, they are so accustomed to the presence of humans that they're really unfazed by it.
Yes, that's true, up to a point. They are what we would call tolerant of people, meaning they would see a car or a person by the side of the road from, say, a mile away. They wouldn't approach, but they wouldn't necessarily fear that person either. In the 19th century, of course, wolves learned to fear people because of trapping and hunting. These wolves, many of whom were born in Western Canada, the ones that were originally relocated probably had never seen people. By the time they got to the park, they became very tolerant of seeing people on the roadside. And that was a surprise, by the way. Wolves weren't brought back to be a tourist attraction. They were brought back to fix this broken ecosystem in Yellowstone and the Northern Rockies generally. The guys who – the men and women who ran the program had no idea wolves would stay in this relatively open area, the Lamar Valley, with a road running through it, that they wouldn't mind people standing on the side of the road watching them. And that's been one of the real revelations, and that's been one of the big gifts of the program. It's the one place in the world where you can reliably – park your car on the side of the road, set up a scope, and if you're patient enough, get a chance to see a wolf.
And for a long time, the wolf everybody wanted to see was 06, called an alpha female. Is that typical for wolf packs? Does it mean that she ran her pack?
Well, every pack has a breeding pair, just one breeding pair, and they are commonly known as the alpha female and alpha male. Mm-hmm. Now, this question of who's in charge, the male or the female, is one that goes back. You know, wolves have been studied for decades and decades. And back in the 40s, the sort of the seminal study by Adolf Murie, mm-hmm. Wolves of Mountain McKinley, he thought that the male was generally in charge. And I think what research has shown in Yellowstone is that's not necessarily the case. Without a doubt, 06 was in charge of her family. When she first selected her mate, she rather curiously hooked up with this pair of young brothers who wandered into the valley, just yearlings. And the one she picked as her mate was so naive, and, you know, she essentially had to train them how to be wolves.
This podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter. What if hiring could be easier? So even when you're busy, you can still be smart about how you hire. With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to over 100 top job boards with just one click. Then their smart technology notifies the most qualified candidates to apply. No wonder 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. Right now, you can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/OP. That's ZipRecruiter.com/OP. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the wolves back in Yellowstone. You can hear them right there. Wolf packs, wolf cubs, pups, wolf glory, wolf issues. These are top predators who change things. Nate Blakeslee is with us from Austin, Texas, writer-at-large for Texas Monthly, and out with a new book, very compelling, American Wolf, a true story of survival and obsession in the West. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. He's followed them closely. Lots of Yellowstone visitors who get out there and watch these days. Here's a group of Yellowstone visitors watching three wolves in the distance as they move through a field in Yellowstone National Park near an elk.
She's almost directly underneath the elk.
Yes.
Like, she's moved to the right now, but she's almost directly underneath.
Yeah, she's almost past that.
Going to the herd?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I only see two.
There's two, and then there's one over the wolf.
They're bypassing.
Oh, okay.
You can see they've got a very clear view, and it is exciting. Wolves reintroduced in 1995-96 to Yellowstone. At this point, about 100 in Yellowstone National Park, about 1,700 now across Montana, Idaho, Wyoming, Oregon, Washington State. And they always get the human imagination going. And more than that, there are material issues. Hunters who want to take those elk themselves, ranchers worried about the wolf toll on their herds. You can join the conversation with Nate Blakeslee. His new book is American Wolf. Can you picture how these wolves live? Do you know the story of 06? This wolf, her fame, her charisma, her role in the wolf world of Yellowstone? And what about the complaints from hunters that the wolves are stealing their trophies, from ranchers that wolves are a threat? Nate, stand by. We've got a lot of callers for you. Meg in Paris, Kentucky. Meg, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you know?
Well, last February, I actually had the privilege of going on an organized wolf-watching trip to the Lamar Valley. And
lucky you.
It was phenomenal.
Yeah.
Yes, lucky me.
Tell us about
phenomenal.
It.
Phenomenal. it was the height of the mating season, and actually the highlight of the trip was witnessing, we were at an area, the call had gone out amongst this very cooperative group of people that watch every day, and they radio to each other when there's been a sighting or there's, you know, activity, and everybody in the cars flies to that area, and we all cooperatively work together and share spotting scopes and get to watch. And so we were in this area divided by a road, and there was a group of wolves on one side of the road kind of sitting amongst some rocks, and there was some howling and some talking going on. And then after a little while of watching them, we started hearing responses coming from the other side of the road from wolves that we hadn't seen yet, but we could hear them. And over the course of a couple of hours of this talking back and forth, finally one of the bachelor wolves, I guess it was, out of that was in this one small group that we'd been watching, got up and started walking, you know, working his way around us. And we saw a big female come down out of the trees from the other side of the road. And we got to witness the entire meet, greet, courtship, consummation,
yep,
and exit. It was just an amazing experience. And prior to that, the spotting scopes, I need to say, are so phenomenal. These things were so far away that with your naked eye, you could see a dark spot that, yep, looked like a rock. And with good birding binoculars, you could, if you knew where to focus, you could focus and you could tell that it was some sort of canine type shape. But with the spotting scopes, it felt like they were right next to you. And the detail was so amazing that when that wolf was howling and would turn his face up to the air to howl, you could see the shimmering heat waves of the vapor escaping from his mouth.
Wow, that is pretty great.
Meg, amazing.
You put us right there, Meg, and I'm grateful for it. That's really terrific. Thank you for that kind of firsthand report. Nate Blakeslee, take us into some of the kind of detail that you found from your own observation and from these deep diaries of wolf watchers, who hundreds of thousands of pages of diaries, the kind of detail that stuck most with you.
Well, that's what surprised me the most is just how much detail and how well individual wolves were known by these watchers. There's a guy named Rick McIntyre. He's sort of the park's wolf guru. He works for the Park Service, and he spends his day helping visitors find wolves. And when they do, he tells stories about them. He can pick out almost any wolf in the park and tell you its lineage, tell you where it lives, tell you if it's had a mate, tell you, you know, he's got a story for every landmark in the Lamar Valley. And inside that diary were just amazing tales. Of course, there were pages and pages of sort of mundane behavior, and mm-hmm, you do have to be patient as a watcher if you, yep, want to see something good. But there were stories of 06 defending her den from grizzlies, of 06 traveling 40 miles in a day round trip to bring elk meat back to the pups at the den. Stories of, you know, these territorial battles are just legendary in the park. Every part of the park is controlled by one pack or another. The leading cause of death for wolves in the park is conflict with other wolves. And, you know, the packs, the watchers live in dread that another pack will invade and one of their favorite wolves will be killed. And so there's always that sort of drama going on. There's always something to look forward to. You know, if you didn't see it today, maybe you will tomorrow.
I'm reading here that wolves in the park live to be about 5. That's double the lifespan outside its borders. Yellowstone's oldest wolf reached 12 and a half years. Those are not long lifespans on the whole, though. We'll hear the story of 06. I mean, you say that she was unique in part because she was a solo hunter. Did you ever witness her take down an elk? The elk can be so big on her own. What was her technique?
I never did, but of course I read many descriptions, mm-hmm, of it, and there's actually some photos and video of her doing that. Typically, a pack will run wolves down as a unit. The faster, sort of fleet-footed females will run the elk to exhaustion, and then the big male, who can be 120 pounds, even larger, will come in and grab the elk by the throat, try to crush the windpipe and, mm-hmm, bring it down in that fashion. Of course, if you're doing it by yourself, you have to be both sort of the legs and the muscle.
Yeah.
And she just really had a knack for that. And she literally did train those two young wolves that I mentioned that became the first members of her pack. One her mate, the other with the mate's brother who stayed with them, which is not uncommon. She really did train them how to hunt elk. Wolves are not born knowing that. They have to be taught. They have to be instructed. And that's something watchers observed from the roadside, is her gradually helping them to become, you know, the wolves that they needed to become.
Wolves, the alpha females, litter every spring, 4 to 7 cubs or pups. You talked about a breeding pair in each pack. Does that mean only one female breeds in a pack?
Yes, packs are really families. You have the breeding male and female. You have the pups from that year's litter. And then you have yearlings or 2 or even 3-year-old wolves that haven't dispersed yet. Occasionally, lone wolves will be allowed to join the pack, usually young males. And one of them might become the beta male who would replace that breeding male if he were to die. Generally, though, if a wolf wants to breed and have a territory of his or her own, they have to leave. They have to become lone wolves. It's extremely dangerous. They have, as soon as they leave their territory, they're at risk of being attacked by other packs. They have to first find a mate and then find an area that is not already saturated with wolves and try to establish a territory of their own. Most of them never succeed. So in a sense, every wolf's life is this sort of amazing adventure story, this attempt to sort of triumph over adversity. 06's in particular was just unusually fascinating and, of course, was so carefully detailed and documented that we had all of that at our disposal when I tried to write the story.
American Wolf is the book. Call us for you, Nate. Marcia in Lexington, Kentucky. Thank you for calling, Marcia. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm wondering why wolves have such a sinister reputation with human beings. I can think of other animals that hunt in groups and similarly, but wolves are just really singled out as being evil or vicious. I mean, bears hunt things down, cheetahs hunt things down, but we think of these animals as almost noble, or we can see their more noble characteristics, but it's not true with wolves.
What do you say, Nate? You've paid attention.
Yes, that is a wonderful question. It is the answer. You have to go very far back in time. You know, there are no two species on this planet that have sort of had their destinies intertwined the way wolves and humans have had. As Tom mentioned earlier, wolves were once the most widely distributed land mammal on the planet, found almost everywhere in the Northern Hemisphere, and now Homo sapiens is. And every gain that humans made since they came out of Africa and established early agrarian civilizations came at the expense of wolves. You may wonder why there are so many wolf metaphors in the English language, the wolf at your door, leader of the pack, when most of us have never seen a wolf. It's because when Europeans first arrived in the United States, wolves were literally everywhere. And if you were a farmer or you were a shepherd, you talked about wolves the way we talk about the weather today. It was the one thing, it was the obstacle that had to be overcome in order to establish the civilization that the people were trying to sort of scratch out of the dirt.
Because of attacks on humans or on livestock?
Because of attacks on livestock, yes. If you, take yourself back to the frontier, 19th century, you've got one cow, you've got a few chickens, you've got a crop that's in. You lose any of that, you're not talking about losing money, you're talking about possibly starving to death. And in those days, it's not like today when you have these enormous, well-capitalized cattle operations with thousands of head. Losing a few calves today is much different. But in those days, it was serious and it was dangerous. And so people really did think of themselves as in this sort of mortal conflict with wolves that had to be won. Now, the question of why, after wolves were essentially removed from huge parts of the country, our ancestors felt like they needed to be completely eradicated is more difficult to answer. And I think it does go back to this demonization that the caller mentioned, which has gone on since medieval times when the werewolf myth was first hatched onto Grimm's fairy tales, where the evil character is always a wolf. But all of that myth-making is all in service of this sort of, pogrom that went on in every European country and in the United States to make the land safe basically for livestock and for agrarian civilizations.
You quote Margaret Atwood from The Blind Assassin at some length here, sort of compellingly in your front piece here. She says, all stories are about wolves, all worth repeating, that is. Anything else is drivel. Think about it. There's escaping from the wolves, fighting the wolves, capturing the wolves, taming the wolves, being thrown to the wolves, or throwing others to the wolves so the wolves will eat them instead of you, running with the wolf pack, turning into a wolf, best of all, turning into the head wolf, Margaret Atwood writing, no other decent stories exist. Marie in Dayton, Ohio, you're on with Nate Blakeslee. Thanks for calling, Marie.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Nate. Hey, I just sort of dovetailing on what you were just talking about. I'm originally from Michigan. I go to the UP. I drive around at night and just hope to hear a wolf. I never have, but I can tell you that the wolf hate out there is intense in places where reintroduction is going on. And it's a big management problem for the DNR and anybody who's pro-wolf.
Because of straight-up wolf hate. And I mean, that's easy. It's easy to find it in history, and it's not hard to find now. I mean, Nate, my folks settling on the prairie in the Midwest in Illinois there, we've still got their records of the fear, just walking through the woods at night with bright torches to keep wolves at bay. And, of course, as they had livestock, they were worried about that. That's still very much there now in the West.
Yes, especially in the Northern Rockies. Now, the impact of reintroduction in the Northern Rockies, we did not see sort of those worst-case scenarios. There have been some livestock losses, but not on a scale that it has threatened the industry. Similar to elk hunting, the state of Wyoming, you have seen robust elk harvests, as they call it, some almost record in recent years, and elk are thriving. However, the politics around wolves has become really poisonous. If you're a politician in the Northern Rockies or even in the West generally, your position on wolves has become a kind of a litmus test, like a gun control or abortion. It's a way of saying what kind of politician you are and what you stand for. Just as an example, the current governor of Idaho, Butch Otter, he ran essentially on an anti-wolf platform. He promised to get wolves off the endangered species list just as fast as possible, and when they were, he promised that he would reduce their numbers through hunting and trapping just as much as he legally could.
Matt in Ontonagon, Michigan, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'd like to my comment is that the wolves are out of control. I am a hunter and a sportsman, and I invite anybody that would stand in the middle of the woods and not be worried about wolves. We see them all the time. And I'm tired of folks in Lansing and California and other people making the decisions for us here in the UP. They've let these wolves run completely wild. There's no control. And they are decimating our deer herd.
Matt, so you're on the Upper Peninsula of Michigan there. Does Michigan have wolf hunting or not, Matt?
Unfortunately, no, Tom. They don't, and it needs to be given back to the state to let our DNR control these apex predators. They are killing machines, and they will not stop until they eat themselves at a house and home, and they'll start starving themselves and getting mange. And I'm a longtime listener. I called in today, and I'm very passionate about this this subject. But wolves are out of control. I don't mind having a few running around, but it is completely unsustainable, and our deer herd is suffering.
Nate, what do you say to Matt, a sportsman from the Upper Peninsula in Michigan, and his observation, out of control?
Well, that idea that wolves would eventually destroy the prey populations, that's what led to them being hunted out in Yellowstone by the 1920s. Ironically, park rangers themselves did that. Of course, at that time, they only had a really rudimentary understanding of wildlife biology. They didn't realize that elk and wolves had evolved in tandem over thousands of years and that they were essentially in balance with each other. And that's what happens wherever wolves are. Now,
Matt's clearly not buying it in the Upper Peninsula.
Yeah. Part of the problem is that there are different public policy goals at play here. You know, when wolves were brought back to Yellowstone, just as an example, the idea was to reduce that elk herd in Yellowstone, that famous elk herd, from 19,000 back down to what it historically was when wolves were still there, say 8,000 to 9,000.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happened. The problem is not everybody shared that goal. And if you're a hunter adjacent to Yellowstone, you want that huge elk herd because those elk come down and they provide excellent hunting opportunities. So it's a question of who sets the goals and who shares them.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The sound there of a pack of wolves howling during the evening while near an elk kill at Soda Butte in Yellowstone National Park. My guest this hour is Nate Blakeslee. He has written deeply into the lives of wolves in Yellowstone. His new book is American Wolf, A True Story of Survival and Obsession in the West. Have you seen these wolves? What's your wolf story? Lots of traffic. Here's a note from online, Nate. Madeline writes to it, "My cat usually naps through On Point, but not this hour with all this wolf howling. Today he woke up with the howls and looks truly concerned." Yeah, well might be. Online, a lot of attention to a viral video that went around of a 2013 TED Talk by British environmentalist George Monbiot describing how reintroducing wolves to Yellowstone National Park set off a trophic cascade. That's a change that starts at the top of a food chain and tumbles down through an ecosystem.
They radically changed the behavior of the deer. The deer started avoiding certain parts of the park, the places where they could be trapped most easily, particularly the valleys and the gorges. And immediately those places started to regenerate.
Okay, we'll look at that, how that may have worked. But there's also pushback. In May, a federal appeals court said Wyoming could manage its wolf population, allowing hunters to kill wolves outside protected areas. Of course, that comes right up against Yellowstone National Park. Here's Gerald Yochum, president of Wyoming Outdoorsmen, talking with Wyoming Public Media.
I'm glad we stuck to our guns on it. We don't have a place for wolves throughout the state.
And here's Denny Iverson, a rancher in Montana, talking with NPR a few years back about the wolves' return to the American West.
I'll make it perfectly clear. I'd just as soon these wolves weren't on the landscape. It'd make my life a whole bunch easier. But they are. So it does no good to sit at the coffee shop or go to Washington, D.C. or Helena and complain about it. We've just got to deal with it.
Nate Blakeslee, where did you come down on hunting around Yellowstone?
Well, as you say, it's legal to hunt wolves in Wyoming now. It has been legal since 2009 to hunt them in Montana and Idaho. So there really is no sort of safe area around the park. Of course, hunting is not allowed in the park, but that doesn't matter because wolves range so widely that every single one of the park's packs will leave the park at some point during its wandering. And in fact, every fall, Yellowstone loses wolves to the hunt. And sometimes they lose animals that have been collared for years and have immense research value. So it's an issue. I never heard a compelling reason, and I talked to a lot of people, for trophy hunting of wolves. Now, wolves are killed under a different rubric, which is culling on behalf of livestock. If you run cattle adjacent to Yellowstone, if you can show that you lost cattle to wolves, a government trapper will come out and shoot those wolves for you free of charge, even if they're on public land. So you don't need trophy hunting to protect livestock. As for the elk herds, again, we've discussed, yes, the Yellowstone elk herd is smaller. Yes, there are fewer hunting opportunities immediately adjacent to the park. But hunting takes place all over Wyoming and all over the Northern Rockies, and hunters are still getting their elk. Now, you sometimes hear a third rationale, which is if you're a game manager in Wyoming or Montana or Idaho, you would like to have a hunt simply because people want to hunt wolves. These agencies are very, very client, customer driven. Most of the funding for, say, the Wyoming's Department of Game and Fish comes from the purchase of hunting licenses. And the idea is that if you allow them to hunt, if wolves are hunted like any other species, some of this acrimony around wolves will eventually go away. I personally have not seen that, and I can understand why, if you're a wolf advocate, you very much resent the idea that all you have to do to remove acrimony around wolves is to allow as many of them to be shot as sportsmen would like to. You can see why that argument is a non-starter with people on the wolf advocacy side.
The wolf that you followed so closely, this magnificent wolf 06, she was safe in Yellowstone. She wasn't safe outside it.
Ironically, one of the very first wolves that was shot during Wyoming's first legal wolf hunting season in decades was the park's most famous wolf, arguably the country's most famous wild animal. She was shot in December of 2012 when she and the pack wandered out of the park just briefly into a little area east of the park called Crandall.
Here's this is a little tape of Doug Smith, a biologist with Yellowstone National Park. He helped reintroduce the wolves there 20 years ago. And then in 2014, he talked with Snap Judgment about how he felt when this wolf that Nate Blakeslee so compellingly follows, 06, when she was killed.
I didn't think they'd get her. And they did. And why they did, I don't know. I thought she was immune. But it's naive to think that we have a wolf running around in Yellowstone that's untouched by humans. And there is a part of me that wishes that was true, that wolves like 06 could be forever wild. So it's painful to confront it and say, we just don't live in that kind of world anymore.
Nate Blakeslee tells the story in American Wolf. The wolf watchers and the folks at Yellowstone are really crushed in a way by this. I mean, the guy, Rick, who you most closely follow here, could barely talk about it when wolf watchers would come and ask about 06.
Yeah, I mean, she was popular enough that when she died, you know, the New York Times ran an obituary mm-hmm. of her. And Rick in particular was so fond of her. Lori Lyman, who I mentioned earlier, was. Rick considered her to basically be part of his family. And you could hear the emotion in Doug's voice. They knew something terrible would happen when that Wyoming first hunting season was legalized. They didn't think that it would be this. The identity of the person who shot her was a secret. It's against the law for Wyoming officials to identify a person who shot a wolf. He himself wisely kept his name out of the papers, fearing a backlash. He did agree to talk to me. I tracked him down early on when I was doing reporting for this story, and he agreed to participate for the book. And his perspective is in the book, albeit we agreed on a pseudonym for him to protect his privacy. But I wanted to have that perspective in there because when people read about 06 being shot in the Times, I'm sure many of them said, who would do such a thing? And the only way to answer that question is to ask the person who did it.
Nate Blakeslee's book is American Wolf. Nate, please stand by there in Austin, Texas. Arthur Middleton joins us right now from Berkeley, California, professor of wildlife ecology, management, and policy at Berkeley. National Geographic Society fellow, runs a field project in the Rocky Mountains studying large mammals and predator-prey interactions and animal movements. Arthur Middleton, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Glad to be with you.
Overall, nearly two decades after reintroduction, by your lights, as a wildlife ecology management guy, how's it going in Yellowstone and beyond?
Well, it's going really well. Wolves are doing really well in the Yellowstone ecosystem, so much so that they've expanded far to the west, into Oregon, Washington, now a bit into California, beyond the Yellowstone ecosystem, and to the north, connecting back up to populations in Canada. So, as Nate and your callers so well illustrate, the recovery of the wolf is really fraught with emotion and controversy and lingering social and other challenges. But from a biological standpoint, it's been just a tremendous success story. From 41 wolves that were reintroduced to Yellowstone National Park to now, I think, more than 500 in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem, the 22 million acres that includes the 2 million acres of Yellowstone National Park, with many times that number and growing in areas, again, beyond the Yellowstone ecosystem.
What kind of steady state do you anticipate if there's going to be one? I used to spend a lot of time in Alaska where there were lots of wolves in remote parts of Alaska. In the lower 48, what kind of steady state do you anticipate, Arthur?
Well, I mean, that's hard to say. Again, wolves are still expanding. And so, you know, depending on what scale we're talking about, you know, if we sort of limit our discussion to the Yellowstone ecosystem, we're starting to see maybe something like a steady state. But if we sort of zoom out, you know, across larger and larger areas of the West, again, we're still seeing numbers, you know, continue to grow. And it's, you know, basically what we find is that when there's sufficient wilderness to anchor a wolf population and is surrounded by additional areas with at least relatively few people, wolves can really thrive. And that's basically because, in contrast with our kind of conventional idea that these top predators are really sensitive and easily threatened, wolves reproduce quite quickly and they recolonize new areas quickly and quite well. And so, you know, we can talk more about hunting, but at the end of the day, you know, So hunting's an emotional issue. It's a fraught issue because it jumbles up questions about social values and ethics and cultural differences, mm-hmm. and history. But if we pull out the biology, wolves can thrive in the face of hunting and in the face of management to reduce conflicts with livestock and other things.
What about their interface with pets, cattle, people? Lower 48 is not what it was 100, 200, 300 years ago, or 3,000.
No, and I think there have been some good points and some good discussion in the show so far. I think one of the things that's important for people to recognize, as again, many of these things are sort of scale dependent. If we look, as I think Nate did in a comment earlier, at the elk hunting success and opportunity at a regional scale or a statewide scales, or if we look at effects of wolves and other predators on livestock operations at a big regional or statewide scale, then we can see those effects to be relatively small compared to other things. But that's not how people work. People live in localities, and the way that wolf effects on big game and livestock operate varies across localities in strength. And so if you're someone who lives right in the middle of a valley that year after year has very acute wolf predation on livestock, then you're pretty upset about it. It might affect you very significantly, even though it's not affecting the industry really widely. And the same kind of goes for big game populations. We see really variable effects. And when you are a outfitter, a guide, or hotels and restaurants associated with those businesses and hunting seasons who are operating in areas where there has been a strong effect on big game, then you're pretty upset about it. And so we need to recognize that these things vary, valley by valley and locality by locality around these regions.
We get a call from Minneapolis in Minnesota. Les is calling. Hi, Les, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Okay.
I just wanted to make a few comments regarding wolves. I grew up in Minnesota, and Minnesota at one point was the only state in the lower 48 that had an appreciable population of wolves, and that primarily because northern Minnesota is predominantly wilderness.
Yeah, know it well. Love it.
And the wolf population has stayed really relatively stable throughout the years. What most people don't realize is that wolves typically will eat smaller animals, rabbits, squirrels, mice, and when they take down a large animal such as a white-tailed deer, they'll more often take down an animal that's sick or elderly. And the populations of wolves in Minnesota has stayed, really quite stable. It's extended a little bit now, but there's a good balance in, because most of northern Minnesota is wilderness. There's a bit of trouble as you approach, some of the, communities, but not so much.
Les, if you'll allow me, let me pick it up there because our time grows short. Arthur Middleton in California, what do you make of that? We had our caller, Sportsman Hunter, maybe you heard him from the Upper Peninsula in Michigan, saying the wolf population there by his lights was out of control and decimating the deer population. Here our Minnesota caller says there's a kind of natural balance here. What do you say, Arthur?
Well, I guess I say, I'm wandering into social ecology here and away from wildlife ecology, which is my training, but people have different values, and people are therefore experiencing, the recolonization and reestablishment of wolves in very different ways. And so that often, is going to map on to whether people, just enjoy being in wilderness and wildlife watching versus hunting and doing other things that can be affected by wolves. And that actually kind of brings us back, I think, to the question about wolves in the Yellowstone ecosystem, and issues about, wolves protected in some areas and not protected in others. And I think there it's just important to recognize, you know, as we scale up to the objectives of different management agencies, again, they've got different values, and often those values are, you know, kind of inscribed in statutory and regulatory guidance that the agencies are operating under. Nate used the phrase customer-driven to describe the state wildlife agencies, but if we look at national parks, they actually are to some degree customer-driven as well. And so they need to provide opportunity for people to see wildlife, to experience wilderness values. And so they take those values really seriously. But then right across the boundary, you've got people juggling their own missions and mandates to provide hunting opportunity, which they are often required to do, and to maintain numbers of species and numbers of large yeah. carnivores like wolves to meet, you know, objectives around mitigating livestock conflict and other things. And so I think as the emotions around these issues fly, it's important to recognize that good people in different agencies and states and federal agencies are really trying to juggle and reconcile tough things that are imposed on them by different sectors of the public.
We've got it. Nate Blakeslee, what did you come away with in a nutshell from this intimate observation of the wolves of Yellowstone?
Well, I didn't realize how political wildlife management was, and that's what I hope readers will take away, that, you know, wilderness is something that has to be created in the West just like anything else, and it's always a struggle.
It's an epic read. The new book is American Wolf. Nate Blakeslee, thank you so much for being with us today from Austin, Texas.
Thank you.
And Arthur Middleton at the University of California, Berkeley. Thank you very much, Arthur. Here's to the wolves. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.